This is a collection of recordings I made with some of the world's most knowledgeable, well-known, and successful whitetail hunters on the planet. I know you're really going to enjoy and learn from the wisdom they share, along with their personal life and their walk with God. I hope you enjoy these classic conversations. Hey, I've got with me Steve Chapman, and Steve, where are you living now?
I live in the big metropolis of Pleasant View, Tennessee. It's about 25 miles north west of Nashville, between Nashville and Clarksville, the home of the 101st Airborne.
Okay. I've got a buddy who always, when he referred to where he was from High Point, Kentucky. He said High Point was the only place that ever flooded every year. He used to tell me it's halfway between Possum Trot and Monkey's Eyebrow. Kind of a funny town. Now your roots are actually from another state. Where are those from?
West Virginia, and I'm grateful that you asked that. I am very proud of my heritage. Grew up there, and my folks still live there, and I met my wife, Annie, there in 1963, back in the 1900s, and very proud of my heritage.
I know you guys have been on the road a long time. I've followed you guys, it seems like forever, but I know Bill Gaither always jokes around and says you've been on the road as long as asphalt. But, but I have followed you guys, and my wife, we've really respected you guys for what you've been doing for many years. You know, Steve, you're an avid outdoorsman, but I noticed that your primary interest is being a hunter. Do you have any specific game animal that you really like to pursue more than any other?
Well, in the last few years, you know, I used to chase deer incessantly. I mean, if the season was 90 days, I was probably out 90 of them, you know. And but when one day a guy said, come go turkey hunting with me. And basically what I did is I put those two critters at the top. They're on the same line. If you ask me for one, I can't tell you because I love hunting both of them.
Yeah, I do too. It's something, you know, I came into turkey a little bit later because I was the same way you are. But turkey is a lot of fun. I know that the white-tailed deer is the most, you know, searched on, you know, Googled word as far as big game animals in North America. And I have had a passion for these for years. And my mother-in-law bought me a book a number of years ago, an audiobook, one of yours. It was A Look at Life from a Deer Stand.
Yeah.
And I used to take that with me when I was on the road, even on the way to the deer stand, you know, at 5 a.m. in my truck, I'd put it in and be listening to it. And it had a great influence on my life. Just to capture more than just the hunt, but just everything that you learn, these lessons. You know, you've got books, another one, Another Look at Life from a Deer Stand. Wow, With God on a Deer Hunt. I'm looking at your bio here. The Pursuit of the Prize, The Hunter's Call. I mean, there's a lot of books you've got out here.
Well, there's a lot to say about it. I've been grateful to be able to add the writing of books to my writing of songs. And it's just my initial purpose for writing the books was to reach out and connect with other hunters. And you know, the books are filled with the answers to, most of them are filled with my answers to a two-word question that every hunter knows and loves, and that's see anything. You know, when we come back to the truck or a cabin, do you see anything? Well, there's a lot more to see out there than just critters, and that's what we're filled with.
You know, every time I'm speaking somewhere, they always ask me, can you recommend another speaker? And I'll always mention your name, Steve Chapman, and they'll say, well, we've had him. It's like everywhere I go. So I know you've been a busy bee. You're out there a lot doing this.
Well, that's funny. I recommend you. So we got a mutual thing happening here.
Well, buddy, I appreciate that. You know, one of the things I know that you and I come in contact with, it, especially at these wild game banquets that we do, is you have a lot of young kids that come, and not just young kids. You get a lot of novice hunters beginning, guys that are looking for something maybe a little bit later in life they've wanted to do, but maybe their father never hunted. But a lot of these kids, you know, they're getting stuck, you know, playing Nintendo and PlayStation and Xbox and television and computers, and it just feels like we're kind of losing some of these generations to the passion that we have, you know, being in the great outdoors that God made for us. And if you were sharing some of your wisdom in being successful in the woods, you know, for white-tailed deer, for some of these novice hunters and young hunters, what are some tips or secrets that you could pass on to these guys?
Well, there's a, you know, there's a lot of information. When you ask a guy that's near 60 to start, you know, pouring what I've learned into a kid, you know, take a seat, grab a lunch, and just hold on. But probably of all the things I would say to a young hunter, I could wrap it up in three words: safety, safety, safety.
Yeah.
If you want to do yourself, you know, if a young person has gotten into it, or a person that's maybe middle-aged and they've gotten into it, and they discover that they have an immediate passion builds in their heart for the fair chase or the hunt, the best thing they can do to themselves is keep make safety the top priority, because that gives them longevity, hopefully, to enjoy the thing that they've discovered they like to do. And you know, little things as a hunter, like as a young hunter especially, make sure what's behind that animal that you're shooting. You know, not only will you do the animal a favor, but you do the person who might be back there and you don't know they're back there. Just make sure what's behind the animal, little things like that. Make sure you know where, if you bow hunt, where the broadhead is at all times. Don't go digging into a deer and not know where that broadhead is, because you could ruin your hand that way. Just little things. but safety is for me the number one issue. That if I was going to take a young guy hunting, though, that, because when I was taken hunting for the first time by Kenneth Bledsoe up in West Virginia back in 1962-63, that was the thing that he stressed that first morning when we went squirrel hunting. You know, we got up to that fence and he said, "I'll hold that gun for you." And we were standing there in the dark and he said, "Give me that gun. People die crossing a fence with a gun in their hands."
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's the kind of thing, again, it gives you longevity when safety is your priority.
Yeah, you can't be real successful if you're out in the field and you've got accidents like that happening. As a matter of fact, it's going to knock the wind right out of your hunt if you ever have something happen to you out there, because it'll scare the fool out of you. You know, one of the things that I got trained in a couple of years ago was I became a master trainer for tree stand safety. And we hear about accidents constantly happening with these guys that are getting out there and up and down on their tree stands. And boy, you hear about stories like that, and it really does put a fear in you. And it's almost like you start focusing more on the fear than you really do on enjoying the hunt.
Yeah.
But,
well, and then too, you know, there's some things you can't avoid, like, snakes. I'm like Indiana Jones. I hate snakes. I sat down one morning. I was in college, and I was about 17 years old. I went to college early and up in West Virginia, and had a single gauge shotgun, or I mean a new 16 gauge pump shotgun. And I sat down on a stump where I went to college, was in a little town, and you didn't have to go far to hunt. I got up there on the hill and sat down on a stump on a warm, early squirrel season day, and sat there a little bit. And I thought, well, I better get back and get my homework done. I stood up, Brent, and I heard the rattle. And I turned around, and I don't know how I emptied that gun. I just shot in the direction of the sound. And that gun lifted me off the ground as I was running. But, you know, there's little things you can't avoid, like lightning. A storm comes up real quick. But most of the accidents happen by silly mistakes, not thinking and making assumptions. And like getting in that tree stand you're talking about and not checking it if it's been there all year. And don't That's go right. out there and get in it without checking it, because you can kill yourself.
That's right. You know, one of the things, too, is when you have a deer straight underneath your tree stand, one of the biggest mistakes that I made one year was I had a doe right underneath me, you know, easy shot right down through the spine. I've done it many times.
Yeah.
And I somehow wasn't thinking about, you know, your arrow was below your sight on your bow. So when you're shooting straight down, your arrow was, you know, 3 or 4 inches below what you're looking at.
Oh.
And I shot right through the end of my boot.
Oh.
I have no idea how I did not hit my toes to this day. I mean, it went through my boot and lodged in the, you know, the webbing on that. On that tree stand.
Oh my goodness.
But man, those are some mistakes. Safety is huge.
I was going to say dance, pilgrim.
Yeah, that was not a fun experience, but I probably shouldn't even share that, but maybe for the betterment of somebody else listening to this. But
it makes us all feel better when somebody like you makes a mistake like that.
Yeah, when somebody makes a mistake, it's like somebody like me. I mean, I'm the king of mistakes.
Yeah.
You know,
but
you get
like,
a lot of...
It's like Arnold Palmer hitting a really bad shot, and you say, shucks, I can do that.
Oh, man. Yeah, golf is another beast. We'll talk about that another time. I don't want to embarrass myself here. Now, you get a lot of guys coming to these events, and they're coming because they really want to hear about hunting. You get some guys that are coming because they know your stories, they know your songs, you know, they've heard about you as a speaker and so down to earth. But you get a lot of guys that come because they love the outdoors. And a lot of these guys that are coming are very experienced hunters. I mean, these guys know what they're doing. I learn a lot by just listening at these events after the and before the event. But I know you've had a chance to read some of your books where you've gone with some guides and traveled around, and probably some of the best guides that we have here in North America. And you've had a chance to maybe look over their shoulder, be with them, and learn from them as well. When these guys are coming, really have a lot of experience, what's something that you can pass on to them, to the experienced hunter, just like the novice, it's really going to help, you know, help them be successful in the field?
Yeah, it's probably near impossible to tell an advanced or an experienced hunter something new that he doesn't know. But I've learned a few things later on in my life as a hunter that surprised me, that, you know, why didn't I think of that? For example, a guy said, well, if you want to know if you're going to a new piece of property, which I love to do, and, you know, hunt a place I haven't seen before, when you get there, if there's some barbed wire fence, he said, the first thing you do is go walk the fences and check out, you know, the tufts of hair that are left there, because that'll tell you what's in the area.
Yeah.
And then he said, you know, there'll be deer, maybe bear, old hippies, you know, crawling through those fences. And that really works. Especially if you find where they're traveling, you can find what's there. And that was a unique discovery that I appreciated. Some other things, you know, I mentioned about the broadhead in the deer cavity. That was a lesson that I learned from a guy whose hand was all boogered up. And I mean, for a guitar player like I am, that sowed the fear of God in me when he said, you know, make sure you know where that broadhead is at all times. If you don't find it stuck in the ground, just assume that it's in that deer somewhere.
That's right.
And
that's right.
That way you can save your hand. And
I slipped my thumb one time all the way down to the bone, and it was the wind chill that day was 12 below zero.
Oh.
And I didn't feel it. And it's one of these things, you take your hand out, you've been, you know, working on the deer, and you pull it out, and you're going, wow, that's not cleaning off.
Uh-huh.
And you begin to realize it's you.
Yeah.
And I was
and
one of
these. And you're making me feel better here.
Oh, it was one of those diehard. I went back to the truck because I had a couple of tags. I checked the deer in, duct taped my thumb back up, and went back to the woods.
Yeah. Only a real diehard hunter would do.
I'm telling you. Sometimes, you know, it gets foolish.
Another thing that I want to pass on to the veteran hunter. I talk to a lot of guys who say all I hunt is trophies, and I can do that real easy. But I was admonished one day, you know, don't forget about the does, and do your part. This guy said, do your part for your state, for your area, and take some does. And, you know, I took that to heart because, you know, all of us would like to have the big rack to hang on the wall. But conservation in this nation, one of the main components to it is the hunter. And we need to do our part. We need to encourage the young ones to do the same.
Yeah.
But there's one other thing real quick, Brent, that I wanted to say to the veteran hunter, and specifically to that older guy who's troubled in his heart that he may be feeling like he's lost that fervor for the hunt, you know, the eye of the tiger. There's a lot of us that get around 60, 65, and we just abandon the hunt because we don't have the feeling for it. You know what I mean? It's a fire that once burned that might be flickering down to, just a few embers. But the way to restoke those fires, I've found, is to to consider the value of helping people put meat on their table. Like when deer season's approaching, see, Annie and I, it's just the two of us now. Our kids are grown, they're all married and potty trained and everything. They're out of the house, and it's just the two of us. And seriously, you know, one deer for us is plenty. Maybe a deer and a half, but I love to hunt, and I don't want to hunt without a purpose. And sometimes these guys may feel like the reason they feel that the fervor of the fire is going out is because they're lacking a purpose. And so in order to foster that purpose, I'll make some phone calls. I'll say, I'll call a family and say, would you guys like a deer this year? Because if I'm going out there to hunt with a purpose, more than just the kill, I'm more apt to, you know, feel stoked about it when I get up. And another way to do that is to take a kid hunting. There's nothing sweeter than the look on a kid's face when that deer comes in and they start breathing heavy and they get all excited. You know, that's just a thrill for an older guy like me. You know, that just helps keeps the fires burning in the heart. And these guys that tell me they've lost it and they don't go anymore, you know, if they'll find a purpose, it'll come back.
Yeah. I know from reading your stories, you have a lot of great insights. I hear it even in what you're talking about now. When you go out, you're more than just, you know, a guy that's, again, counting points. I hear you counting experiences and literally counting it all joy, all the things you're learning because you're constantly learning new things. Well, when you think, go ahead.
Yeah, let me add to that, Brent. I'm one who believes that God wires people to enjoy, to appreciate, to have a passion for certain things. Like in Exodus, there were, you know, when they built the temple and all the places of worship, many times in Exodus it says, and God poured into these craftsmen the wisdom to do it. In other words, he wired them to work with brass. He wired them to work with embroidery. And I think those of us who hunt were wired to hunt. And God wants to use that passion that he put in us as a way to speak to us. Again, that's another way to restoke the fires of hunting is to find, you know, that purpose out there.
Yeah.
Look for things that are just, they may not have fur and feathers, but there's other harvests of truths that we can find out there.
You know, as I'm listening to you speak and the guys are going to be hearing this, you know, they can tell you're so down to earth. And you must be a really fun person to hang out with because you've got some great stories. What I typically at this point are asking guys, you know, what's the greatest hunting lesson that you've learned in the last 10 years that's helped your success? And I think we kind of maybe covered a little bit of that, but I would almost want to ask you, and this is kind of off the cuff here, this is going to be one that I didn't kind of prep you on, but when you think about all your years of hunting, something from you I'd like to ask is, what is maybe one of the funniest memories that you've had being out in the woods?
Well, I mean, that's a huge task to come up with the one I like most. I think that first morning I turkey hunted, a guy named Don Skurlock and his friend Eddie owned the property, and Don said, "Won't you go hunt turkey hunting with us?" I think what I laugh about is what a goonie I was to them, not having any idea what I was doing. And turkeys, you know, they're coming in across the field, and I'm sitting there rearranging the place I'm sitting and trying to act like I'm not there.
Right.
You know, a turkey's eyes, you know, how good they are. But I'm sitting there and these birds got within about, I don't know, 50 yards. And Don looked over at me with that, "You idiot," kind of. And I've chuckled more probably about thinking about what they were thinking, knowing now what silence and stillness it requires to hunt turkey. And I'm over there having lunch, you know?
Yeah, right.
Just little things like that. There's a plethora of them.
And I was interviewing a guy named Danny Dodge yesterday. He'll be a part of this project. He has a television show called Living the Wildlife. And he said, basically reiterated what you just said was, I said, what's the greatest mistake you see hunters making? He said movement.
Yeah.
He said, from the camera lens, you get to see what these guys are doing. They're not focused on how much they're moving. I get to see exactly what's happening and what you know these animals pick up on. Yeah. And he said, movement is probably one of the greatest mistakes that we make. It really is a pleasure to be able to have you on here. And I've seen you speak. I saw you last year here in Indiana. Watched the guys just really get captivated by your stories. But even more so, when guys walked away from that night, they said there was something that was just extra special, this down-to-earth that you have in your faith in God. And I want to bring this back down to the last question is maybe something that's near and dear to your heart that you love to be able to say to these guys, that even more so than about hunting, about your own passion. And you've mentioned a few things to me. You know, just elaborate on that just a little bit.
Well, there's a couple of things. You know, Annie and I, through the years, are the focus of our work as musicians and authors. The primary focus was and or has been the family and husbands, wives, parenting, as many facets of family life as we can cover at an event, we will. Kids being one of them, you know, and always try to remind folks at these live events, especially the dads, not to abandon their kids in order to enjoy the outdoors, but to use the outdoors as a platform, as a way to reach the kids' hearts. You know, thankfully, my kids have two, Nathan and Heidi, enjoyed hunting and Heidi enjoyed fishing. So, I mean, how much better could it get?
Yeah.
But I always kept in mind that familiar, well-used passage among those of us who believe in God and walk with Christ and appreciate the outdoors, that Romans 1:20 passage, you know, about his God's invisible attributes, his eternal power, divine nature, been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. That I kind of pasted that on the inside of my eyelids as a dad, to not abandon the kids, but to take them out into the outdoors and enjoy, not only enjoy it, but to use it as a way to teach them and to just be with them. Kids spell love, T-I-M-E. But another sidebar to that is for a dad who is just immersed in hunting, that's his passion, and he wants his kids to get involved. He's got to keep in mind that, like I said before, God may not have wired those children to hunt, or that child, or that son or daughter. And if he forces a child into that world, the dad might be tampering with a core character that God wants to use somewhere else. And for that reason, he should find another interest in the outdoors that the kid enjoys, maybe riding bicycles or camping or kayaking or canoeing or something like that, to enjoy with that child. And if he needs to force himself to enjoy it, then do so for the sake of the kid. But to forcing him or her into that mold of being a hunter, it might be a mistake. You have to watch him when you're hunting with him. If you take him for the first time and you shoot an animal or they shoot an animal, watch their demeanor. If they are excessively remorseful, then you might not have a hunter on your hands, and you may need another way to be with them. And the other thing, of course, that I always try to address is to remind the deer hunter that there's two ways to spell deer. And if he's going to make a big mistake if he makes a deer widow out of his wife from September to January, that's not a smart thing to do. But I never encourage these guys not to go. I would be crazy to do that, because they're going to go. I always encourage them that they can go, and I teach them how they can go hunt and not feel guilty about it and still keep a good marriage. And I did that through a book called A Good Husband's Guide to Balancing Hobbies and Marriage, which I wanted to call, by the way, How to Help Your Wife Not Hate What You Love to Do. But the publisher didn't like it, though. Wife and hate in the same title. So, but they gave it actually a better title, I think, that, you know, keeping the balance between your hobbies and your marriage. But I always address that. And those two things are primarily on my heart when I go to do a wild game dinner. You know, I'm not a deer expert. Charlie Alzheimer and these guys who know how much a deer's nose hair grows every year, and how their eyesight, why their eyesight is so incredible and that kind of thing. There's experts who will cover that. I think the Lord has directed me to speak to the hunter help him keep a balance in life, and that's my passion.
That is the word. When you were just saying that, I was thinking what you're doing is you're helping us keep a balance, because we can get really wrapped up on trophies. We can get really wrapped up on our equipment. There's so many things that are so much deeper than that stuff that we miss, and we look back and go, oh man, I wish I'd have done that so much differently. You know, with our kids, with our wives. My wife,
Brent, deer don't talk. When we're old and need a drink of water, that deer hanging on the wall, that big old rack, that taxidermy, it's not going to talk to you. It's not going to help you out.
That's right.
But boy, now, Steve, I don't fault guys for enjoying that. I enjoy it. It's part of our lives. It's how we were wired. But not forgetting that there's another deer in our lives is important.
Well, maybe there's good news. Men are supposed to have, what, 10,000 words a day, and a woman has 40. And maybe the thing is, when we go hunting, we can say, honey, I've been saving those 10,000 up for when I got home tonight.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if she'll buy into that or not. But
Oh, no, she won't.
Well, Steve, you know, listening again to you, it is so obvious. Your storytelling comes through. Your down-to-earth, down-to-earthness? I don't even think that's a word, but we're going to use it.
Yeah, we'll do it.
You know, what you bring is so much more. And I know there's a lot of places out there, especially a lot of churches that put on these wild game banquets or would want to bring in you and Annie and being able to do, you know, seminars and retreats. How would they get a hold of you?
Well, there's a couple of ways. They can look at our website, just StephenAnnieChapman.com, all Stephen Annie Chapman, all one word, small caps. Our contact info is there. They could give Stormy Mitchell a call at the Mitchell Group, and you can find that mitchellgroup.org on the web. You can give us a call. We're accessible. We're 615-746-9931. That's our office, and we can direct them to the folks who can help them arrange those kind of things. We'd love to do it. My ongoing assessment of being at wild game dinners and doing those kind of things is I feel like a pig in mud.
You get to eat really well at those things, don't you?
I do. I've eaten everything from, deep fried rattlesnake, which tastes like a really long chicken, to alligator, and you name it, and I've eaten it, and totally love it.
I had squirrel soup last week. I think I had squirrel, but not squirrel soup. That was a first for me.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, that was interesting. That was down in Alabama.
Yeah.
Well, buddy, thank you so much for being a part of what we're doing here. And again, thank your wife, Annie, for allowing you to have some time to do this. And keep writing, keep singing, keep hunting for truth. And hopefully I'll see you in the woods.
Bless you.